Revolution.
It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I am Tony Vernetti and I am filling in for the attorneys at Shaw, Bransford, and Roth who bring you Fed Talk every week. They are out and about, I'm happy to report, defending federal employees throughout the country so they're unable to make the show. But fear not, I am here and we've got a very exciting show for you today. My in-studio guest is John Adler, the national president of the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association. And we plan to talk about the latest issues affecting federal law enforcement. Good morning, John. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tony. Good morning.
Just a reminder that Fed Talk is brought to you by our sponsor, Geico, where 15 minutes could save you 15% on car insurance. For more information on Geico, please visit them at their website at geico.com. If you would like to join our discussion today and speak directly to John, ask questions about FLIOA or your latest concerns about federal law enforcement, please do call in or send us an email. You can call us at 1-877-936-9333, or you can email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Now, we've got a jam-packed show, a lot of issues to get into, John, but just for you know, our listeners that are new to Fed Talk, haven't heard you on the show before, or new to federal law enforcement, please introduce your association to us.
Sure. The Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association represents approximately 26,000 federal law enforcement officers in the United States and some abroad. We have members that come from over 65 different federal agencies, and we, in addition to having agencies or many members coming from a variety of agencies, we also have chapters across the country which engage in a variety of activities, both in the furtherance of our mission as well as nonprofit and charitable events as well. And one of the key components of our organization is we provide our members access to the best of the best legal services 24 hours a day, in addition to serving as the voice of federal law enforcement on the Hill and for legislative areas.
And if I could shout out to all you in federal law enforcement, you really should, if you're not involved in FLIOA, you really should visit them on their website, learn more information about them. In addition to the legal services that John mentioned, which we're going to talk about here in our first topic, you've got tremendous advocacy support on Capitol Hill and in the executive branch. And your organization is only as strong as its members, and the more of you that get on board with these issues that affect you folks in federal law enforcement, the more you can get done. So with that, let's jump into our first topic. We want to talk about the situation going on down in the U.S. Virgin Islands, where the local police down there are actually prosecuting a federal agent, an ATF agent, who, in the performance of his official duties, ended up killing a local person down there. John, tell us a little bit about the facts of that case.
Yeah, in the latter part of 2008, our member and ATF agent got involved in a situation where he stepped up in heroic fashion to protect somebody, a particular woman, from sustaining serious bodily injury or even worse than that, possible death. He intervened in a situation, as his agency encourages him to do lawfully, where he perceived that one particular individual was about to suffer serious harm. The man in question, who he ultimately stopped, First was out there without any clothing on, screaming, ranting and raving, verbally abusive, threatening physical harm to this woman. He ultimately picks up large rocks and starts smashing her car with it. She then runs to sort of get safety in our member's vehicle, and ignoring verbal commands and rational thought, this individual continues to come at them and bearing what I'm told is a large, very large maglite, coming at them, exhibiting aggressive behavior with the apparent intention of causing bodily harm. Our guy steps up, intervenes, shoots and stops the lethal threat, and prevents himself and the woman from sustaining serious bodily injury. Unfortunately, everyone with common sense perceives that as a heroic response, and Will, and that's who we're referring to, deserves commendations for what he did. The Virgin Island Attorney General, unfortunately, saw it as a means to indict him rather than praise him for saving someone's life. So,
and I think there, you know, really, you know, ensues a major sort of political battle, a major legal battle. The case actually brings some very, very fascinating legal principles to the forefront, some constitutional principles, you know, right out there for the courts to deal with. And we're very fortunate to assist us with that part of the discussion. We're actually able to have one of Will's lawyers join us. She was able to call in because while I am a lawyer, I barely play one on radio anymore. And Lisa Fishberg, who is a partner at Schertler and Honorado, who is actually defending Agent Clark, is with us this morning. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning. Good morning, Tony. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us today. If you could just sort of set kind of the legal stage for us. I think the first thing to point out would be, you know, as I look at this, you know, the Virgin Islands, it's a territory. So almost immediately, you know, you look at no diplomatic immunity applies.
Well, that's right. And what happened in Special Agent Clark's case is what would happen, I think, for most federal agents. And that is, when you're initially charged with a state crime, the first thing you want to do is try and get your case removed from the state and have it taken to the federal court. There is a federal statute that allows federal agents to remove their cases from state court and take them up into a federal court so that questions regarding federalism and defenses that are available to federal agents can be heard in a federal forum. And that is what was attempted in Special Agent Clark's case. Unfortunately, it wasn't entirely successful. The federal district court determined that it would not hear Special Agent Clark's case and remanded it back to the Virgin Islands local court. So Special Agent Clark is being prosecuted in the local courts down in the Virgin Islands, although we believe it should be heard in a federal forum.
So Lisa, let me stop you right there and just emphasize that point. I mean, the first thing that would normally be done is we would remove the case to federal court so that a federal question can be answered by the federal judiciary, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And that's applicable to any federal agent who is acting under color of law, has the right under federal statutes to remove their case from a state court into a federal court.
And so in this case, the district court, I believe in South Florida?
It's actually the district court in the Virgin Islands.
They okay, so the district court, I'm sorry, district court in the Virgin Islands refused to remove it and remanded it back to the Virgin Islands. And what was their rationale?
Well, the rationale was, we think, flawed. We think it was a flawed proceeding in terms of the evidentiary proceeding that the federal district court held. But ultimately, what the district court judge's findings were that Special Agent Clark had not presented sufficient evidence to show that he was, in fact, acting under color of law. We disagree with the factual finding as well. There was evidence presented. There was an ATF agent who did testify that Special Agent Clark in protecting himself and protecting this woman who was being attacked was acting within the scope of his authority under ATF policies and regulations.
And Lisa, didn't ATF actually, I mean, ATF, the federal agency, actually support it and stated that also, right?
Yes. My understanding of the ATF policy is that anytime there's a shooting involving one of their agents, they do a thorough investigation to determine what happened and was it a justified shooting. And the conclusion was in this case that indeed it was a justified shooting. Nevertheless, the local Virgin Islands Police Department and the Virgin Islands Attorney General disagreed with that finding.
Now, I mean, I could tell you myself, being a former attorney for the ATF, they do a very thorough investigation. Lisa, we need to take our first break. I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, to hold on the line. We'd like to continue this conversation on the other side. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm talking with FLIOA President John Adler, and we have Lisa Fishburn from the law offices of Schertler and Honorado. We'll continue our discussion after the break and a word from our sponsor.
And now, a word from our good friends at GEICO, where you could save 15% on car insurance. By now, you've no doubt seen those car insurance commercials with the talking gecko on TV. He's always talking about how people could save 15% or more switching to GEICO. Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal in and of itself. But get this. If you're an employee of the federal government, you may be eligible to save even more than that. That's something the GEICO didn't mention in all those commercials. And you've probably heard many times about how many people have switched to GEICO. Millions. But what you might not know is how many people stay with GEICO once they've switched. In fact, on average, GEICO customers who are federal employees have stayed with the company for over 20 years. Now that's customer satisfaction. Sound like a good deal to you? Then just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO or go online to geico.com and find out how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I am Tony Vernetti, and today my in-studio guest is John Adler, the National President of Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association. If you have a question or comment, please give us a call at 877-936-9333 or email us a question at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Before the break, we were speaking with Lisa Fishburg from Schertler in Honorado, who is one of the attorneys representing Special Agent Will Clark down in the Virgin Islands. And Lisa, before we broke, we were dealing with the issue of the case being remanded to federal court. Now, I understand that has been appealed to the Third Circuit, correct?
Well, that's correct. The decision by the federal district court to remand the case back to the Virgin Islands State Court is up on appeal right now. Generally speaking, remand decisions that are made by district courts are not subject to appeal. There's a statute that prohibits appellate review of those decisions, so that district courts have a lot of authority and discretion to review a case, determine whether or not there are grounds for the case to be in federal court, and if they find there are not grounds, they send it back down. That's usually not a decision that is subject to immediate appeal.
So the actual issue up on appeal is whether, in this case, the district court has that unfettered discretion and whether the issue of remanding is even appealable?
That's correct. The issue the Third Circuit is grappling with right now is, do they even have the ability to review the district court's decision to send the case back down to the Virgin Islands? There's some Supreme Court law that is favorable to us and that we've relied upon, but it has not been decided. The Third Circuit has not yet acted on it. So as a result, when the case is remanded, there's no stay. The case just simply proceeds down in this case, in the territorial court for the Virgin Islands.
So let's fast forward to more recently. So the whole idea to get the federal court is to get the federal question answered, which I believe in this case is the immunity the immunity question and the supremacy clause.
Right.
Tell us about the decision on that.
Well, the basis for Special Agent Clark even removing his case and seeking a federal forum is that he has a federal defense available to him, and that is that he is entitled to immunity pursuant to the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution. What that provides is that any federal agent who is acting under the authority of federal law and who takes actions that are within the scope of their duties and that are reasonable and proper and necessary cannot be subject to any sort of a prosecution for those acts. That's what the Supremacy Clause provides. And it's more than just a defense. It's an actual immunity from suit, so that federal agents shouldn't be subject to being brought into court in state forums where they have been acting under federal authority.
Right, and for our non-lawyers out there, it's and actually, John can attest to this, I actually have the Constitution open and reading from it. It's the Article 6. It says the Constitution and laws of the United States shall be supreme. And the law that you're talking about is the immunity doctrine, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So how did the Virgin Islands courts decide on that issue?
Well, the Virgin Islands court has decided, once the case was remanded, we moved on Special Agent Clark's behalf to have the case dismissed on the grounds that he's entitled to immunity pursuant to the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. The Virgin Islands Superior Court judge issued a ruling which held that the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution does not apply in the Virgin Islands.
It's you know, and I can quote from the decision here. I mean, for me, it's almost an inflammatory language. It's you know, she cites Judge Brenda Holler that the Constitution does not follow the flag, and that not every provision of the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, is applicable in the Virgin Islands. That's a pretty broad, sweeping statement.
It is. There are some provisions of the Constitution that have been held inapplicable in unincorporated territories such as the Virgin Islands. For example, they don't have people in the Virgin Islands don't have the right to grand jury presentment as they do here in the 50 states. If, however, there's a fundamental right that's at issue, then, of course, the Constitution does apply in our view. So we think that Judge Holler's decision is completely erroneous. The Department of Justice actually filed something like an amicus.
An amicus, a friend of the court.
They filed a pleading, a statement of interest on behalf of the United States in support of Special Agent Clark and urging the court to find that the Supremacy Clause does in fact apply to the U.S. Virgin Islands, which would then provide a level of protection for federal agents who are working in the U.S. Virgin Islands. But the judge rejected the rejected our arguments.
And what's sort of getting lost in all this is you know, there's a murder charge on the table. There's a trial date ticking. Are you able to get what's called an interlocutory appeal on this issue in the Virgin Islands?
We are not, and that's something that is actually quite unique, I think, to the U.S. Virgin Islands. Generally, if a party claims that they're immune from suit, immunity decisions are subject to immediate review because, again, immunity is more than just a defense.
Right.
It's claiming that you don't even have to stand trial.
Correct.
And that is something that is generally reviewable immediately by an appellate court. When the trial court here said there is no supremacy clause immunity, Special Agent Clark doesn't have immunity, we did attempt an interlocutory appeal to the Virgin Islands Supreme Court. That is a court that's 3 or 4 years old. It is a new procedure for them. The Virgin Islands Supreme Court looked at it and said, we're not going to be bound by federal law, which says we have to review this immediately, and they rejected the appeal and dismissed it. So Special Agent Clark is now facing a July 12th trial date on some very serious charges, and some of them carry very, very severe mandatory minimum penalties.
Now, Lisa, are you able, I think back in my old appellate days, that once the record was created, what went up on appeal you were stuck with, but are you able to get this decision from Judge Holler, are you able to get that to the Third Circuit for them to use in their, you know, in their decision-making capacity?
Eventually we will, but there's no mechanism for us to do that right now. The way we could have done it and what we attempted to do was to have the Virgin Islands Supreme Court rule. The Virgin Islands court system is, again, it's somewhat in its infancy, so the Third Circuit maintains some overview of the Virgin Islands Supreme Court, but it's almost like you have to seek the permission of the Third Circuit to review it. At this point, we don't have the ability to immediately go to the Third Circuit. Down the road, we would be able to do so.
It's just, you know, by way of summary, it's just amazing to me that we have a federal official operating under the color of federal law, and there's a charge, and we have no ability to get the federal question answered. I'm sure the district court judge makes a decision that says, okay, the constitutional question can be answered by the state, you know, the state jurisdiction. But here they're saying, you know, it doesn't apply here.
That's exactly right. If this had been in any of the states, if, for example, this incident had happened in Virginia, Maryland, Florida, wherever, even if Special Agent Clark had sought the removal and the remand, the trial court in Florida or Virginia or Maryland or wherever would still be required to address his federal defense, would still have to have an evidentiary hearing to determine, is he entitled to immunity under the Supremacy Clause? Because this happened in the U.S. Virgin Islands, that defense of immunity has been completely lost to Special Agent Clark. So he is at a tremendous disadvantage just by nature of the fact that this was in the Virgin Islands as opposed to within any of the other states.
Wow. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for coming on and walking us through that. You know, I guess one comfort I do have personally, and also want to give a shout out to your other law partners who are working the case, Mark Schammel and Vince Cohen. You know, as somebody who has worked his life defending federal law enforcement officials and, you know, doing so in my current capacity, I do feel comforted that he is in very, very, very good legal hands with your law firm there at Schertler in Honorado.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. John, what has been the ramification, you know, of this, you know, what's going on down there, you know, on the ground? I know ATF has pulled all their agents out. They pulled all their agents out of the Virgin Islands, correct?
That's correct, and we applaud that. And I got to tell you, listening to that, and I appreciate that, that was a very, you know, very insightful summary of what's transpired, and it's very disconcerting. And I can tell you right now, when it happened, when ATF pulled out all of their agents from the Virgin Islands, we stepped up and publicly applauded it. And the reason being very simple. This is not a legal principle. This is a common sense principle. We're not going to put our heroes in harm's way to defend people, or to defend a process, a legal process, that does not respect the rule of law. You know, we were discussing the nuances of the Third Circuit. It should never have gotten to this far. There should be no legal questions. The man responded, if they look objectively at the fact pattern and interview the witnesses, he never would have been charged, and it's disgraceful what they did. So, you know, going from that, I just want to make clear, you know, there's a saying that you can indict a ham sandwich. Will Clark is a hero. He's not a ham sandwich, and we're not going to sit back and let him get treated like one. You know, we're not suggesting that Will or anyone else or any of our law enforcement members there are above the law. We're saying the Virgin Islands needs to respect the rule of law. And I encourage every law enforcement director, please, your agent will be next. Pull your people out of the Virgin Islands right now. They're in harm's way for no reason at all. Obviously, the judiciary there does not respect what we're doing. They can't grasp a very simple concept of responding to an incident that involves imminent danger. Therefore, it makes sense. We need to send them a unified, resounding message. Pull our American law enforcement officers out of there. And if they want to function as the lawless islands instead of the U.S. Virgin Islands, God bless. But we don't belong there if they don't respect the rule of law.
And I know that there's been, you know, there's been some support politically in the Virgin Islands. I know there's been some recent legislation introduced there that would actually grant peace officer authority to federal officials in similar situations and, you know, extend the immunity doctrines. But there was a considerable local outcry to that. They, they came, some of the more vocal local political officials, were able to come in and essentially squash that. And, and it's resulted in, while ATF has pulled out, my sources tell me while, FBI, DEA, and the other federal law enforcement agencies that have their boots on the ground there, investigations and work has come to a halt. You're not willing to, to put your life on the line when you're not going to have the protections that you need to do your job. We have to stop here for a break. We'll continue with our discussion after a word from our sponsor. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
And now, a word from our good friends at GEICO, where you could save 15% on car insurance. When you say that you work for the federal government, many people out there immediately picture you wearing a suit, driving a government-issue sedan, and living in D.C. While that may be true for some, in reality, federal employees have a wider variety of jobs than most people could ever imagine, from postal workers to CIA agents, from working in an office to working in outer space. These jobs are all so different that it's hard to believe they have something in common, but they do. And that similarity is GEICO. As employees of the federal government, many of these people may be eligible for additional discounts on top of GEICO's already low rates. And just because the cost is lower doesn't mean that GEICO's service is anything less than top rate. So whether you're in animal control or air traffic control, call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO. Or go online to geico.com and find out how much you could save.
I'm Bill Bransford, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Fed Talk brings you inside information on hot topics in the federal community. From the halls of Congress to federal agencies, get the latest on the laws, regulations, and activities that directly impact federal employees. Tune into Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, as we bring in the experts to bring you inside the issues.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I am Tony Vernetti, and I am here with FLIOA President John Adler. If you'd like to be part of our discussion today, give us a call at 1-877-936-9333, or you can email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. John, just to bring to a conclusion our discussion this morning of the Special Agent Clark situation down in the Virgin Islands, I'm sure concerned agents have reached out to you. I know they had to us at my company, Feds, Federal Employee Defense Services. What advice have you given them, and what can people, who are listening and are outraged, like a lot of us are, what can they do about it?
Well, I hope just listening to this discussion has touched the heart of every listener, whether you're in law enforcement or not. What we are encouraging and what we obviously need is the strong, unified support of our elected officials. Will comes from New York, so his elected senators are both Senator Schumer and Senator Gillibrand. What we encourage everyone from New York and even around the country, please contact Senator Schumer and Senator Gillibrand and let them know that we respectfully request their immediate support to help with Will's situation. We're sort of now running out of options in terms of trying to come up with some effective means to levy some sort of persuasive means to have the folks in the Virgin Islands, the governor et al., come to some reasonable conclusion that they made a drastic mistake. And in particular, Senator Schumer, as everyone knows, sits on the Senate Judiciary Committee, so perhaps he may be able to weigh in as far as the Third Circuit situation goes in terms of encouraging them to perhaps expedite their addressing that important decision. And Senator Gillibrand, sits on the Foreign Relations Subcommittee that has some oversight, I believe, over the Virgin Islands as well. These are two very influential, very effective senators that we would love to get on board and have them represent our situation, as well as every elected official. I mean, November's around the corner. This is a perfect opportunity for all elected officials to show their dedication to the men and women who serve in this country and serve abroad representing our country as well. So if you'd like to contact Senator Schumer and let him know this is an important matter, please tell them you're calling on behalf of Special Agent Will Clark and you want him to immediately get involved and represent our position. To reach his office directly, area code 202-224-4451. To reach Senator Gillibrand, her office in D.C., area code 202-224-6542. And we'll also be posting additional information on the FLEOA website, www.fleoa.org.
Thanks, John. And just to echo again, I mean, one of the most amazing parts of this whole situation, in case, you know, is, you know, that you can't get a federal question answered by a federal court. And a lot of people don't realize, I mean, Agent Clark, having the tremendous support that he had from ATF and the kind of policies that ATF have in place about how they want their agents to respond, you know, is very fortunate, you know, that he's able to get very quality legal representation in this case. And that, you know, I'd be remiss, you know, if I didn't point out, I mean, this case really, you know, begs the question why all folks in federal law enforcement also need to be protecting themselves with professional liability insurance. Let's shift gears to talk about something a little bit more positive. How about that? I know you've been working on the legislative front, something called the Special Agent Samuel Hicks Families and Fallen Heroes Act. Can you tell us about the status of that and what it provides?
Sure. You know, we're very excited in the federal law enforcement community. Public Law 111-178 was signed into law by President Obama on June 9th, 2010. And what this very important piece of legislation, now law, calls for is, in the tragic situation where a federal law enforcement officer is killed in the line of duty, the Department of Justice will pay for the transportation costs and incidental expenditures to fly the deceased, as well as his immediate or her immediate family members, to the agent's home state so everyone can be present for the funeral and all of the ceremonies that would accompany what happens when a hero unfortunately makes the ultimate sacrifice. It's a very important piece of legislation. It's one that I hope no one will have to benefit from, but unfortunately, reality has dictated otherwise, and all one needs to do is attend the candlelight vigil during Police Week each year and, you know, take part in that very important ceremony where we do acknowledge and recognize all of our heroes who made the ultimate sacrifice. So we're very excited. We're very happy. Congressman Mike Rogers, former FBI agent, introduced the legislation. He's been there exuding strong leadership from start to finish. Our friends on the Senate side, Senator Collins, Lieberman, Akaker, Voinovich, all stepped up to make sure the bill covered all of federal law enforcement. Even the FBI Agent Association did a very good job as well, weighing in to support this. We're really happy that we brought this into the end zone. And again, hopefully no one will have to use it, but it's an important thing to have there, a layer of protection.
A lot of folks in the federal community probably don't appreciate that most federal law enforcement officers have to sign what's called the Worldwide Mobility Agreement, which basically means, in legal terms, you could be reassigned for good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all. And, you know, they'll just come in and say it's moving day, you know, and you could be assigned, you know, and you know, lots of times, you know, where they have to go to, you know, to fight the crime, to do the work is not the most desirable place. You know, but they do it for the mission. You know, they do it, you know, because that's the oath they took. And families are affected by that, you know, and then families are, you know, uprooted and moved. So this is a particularly good piece of legislation. I thought I read in there that does it also provide for the move home, the permanent transit station home? It does provide that, just like a regular move, any federal agent would get all the same entitlements.
Yes. Oh. Yes. Yeah, and the important thing here, just to follow up on what you just said, Tony, was a perfect example looking at the southwest border now. You're absolutely right. You see, you know, in the federal law enforcement community, we completely support the president's authority and ability to deploy and move us to areas of greatest need. And again, the border right now is a perfect example. We have a lot of agents from a variety of law enforcement agencies assigned down at the southwest border, and for a good reason, because that's where the priority emphasis is right now. God forbid something should happen, it makes perfect sense that in that tragic situation where someone is killed in the line of duty, you know, they would obviously want to have the body flown back to the agent's or officer's home state. And that's, you know, one of the reasons, or one of the, I guess, examples that demonstrates how important this law now could ultimately be.
Well, that's why I asked the other, because to me, I mean, while that is very important, obviously, to have the burial and funeral, you know, where the family is, but to allow, you know, the family that must go on, you know, to have, you know, the infrastructure of family around them, you know, familiarity, you know, to be able to get that move home, because, you know, in this economy, maybe they couldn't sell the home.
Right.
You know, and get back, you know, and, you know, to go on, you know, with all the, you know, with all the grief that must go on, when a loved one is killed, this, you know, it's good to see some benefits like this coming out of our Congress, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, no, agreed wholeheartedly.
Let's move on to, if you're a frequent listener to Fed Talk, you know, we've talked about this next subject, a lot, the Postal Inspector Pay Equity Act. John, why don't you just set the stage for us and tell us why there's an inequity?
We represent, among all the 26,000 law enforcement officers and agents, marshals, inspectors, and so on, we represent the postal inspectors as well. The postal inspectors are somewhat unique in that their law enforcement pay is loosely codified under Title 39, where the executive branch criminal investigators are codified under Title 5. And under Title 5, we have what's known as LEAP, the acronym LEAP, which is Law Enforcement Availability Pay. For postal inspectors, they have what's called LEP, just Law Enforcement Pay. And what Title 39 says is that they should be paid this law enforcement pay in a manner that's comparable with their counterparts in the executive branch.
Pay and benefits, right?
Yes.
Pay and benefits.
But what the statute fails to do is specify or define who their counterparts are. And they clearly are the criminal investigators in the executive branch. So what this bill calls for is to move their pay and benefits from Title 39 and to codify it under Title 5. And by putting it under Title 5, they would fall under the law enforcement availability pay, which means their law enforcement pay would be statutorily protected. The whole goal when we first brought this topic up and when we sort of touted it out there with the members on the Hill was that our mission is to preserve and protect their pay. We all understand that the postal service is under a tremendous fiscal or financial crisis, and we understand that. But we want to ensure that while they do their level best to come up with a budget that can get them through that miserable storm, they not take one penny away from all of our postal inspectors who, thanks to a decrease in their ranks, are working 10 times as hard as they've ever done, and they've always worked extremely hard. So the answer to the postal crisis is not to take a penny away from postal inspectors. It's to respect them, protect and preserve what their current pay is. We're not asking for more. We're asking to just simply maintain. That's what this bill will do. It'll ensure that our postal inspectors continue to be properly compensated for the tremendous, outstanding work they do every day.
Well, it brings to the forefront the old axiom, you know, you always hear about the postal service. You know, they're government when they want to be. They're government when they want sovereign immunity and they, you know, they don't want to be sued. But they're not government when you tell them they have to adhere to other federal pay rules and regulations. I mean, there are two concepts there. That you're talking about that I think need to be emphasized. You know, one is the, you know, why Title 39 was passed to begin with, the equality part of it. You know, it, really trying to do the Postal Service a benefit in saying, look, I mean, they're federal law enforcement officers. They need to be treated the same as other federal law enforcement officers. Because if they're not, what's going to happen?
Well,
they're going to leave.
They're going to leave. And
so your best trained U.S. Postal inspectors, you know, are going to leave. So it affects and it hurts the mission. Not to mention that they work side by side, OIG agents in the Postal Service that have all those same benefits.
Yeah, and in the case of our OIG special agents, it may very well happen that this bill will be marked up to include them to ensure there is absolute clarity in protecting their pay and benefits as well. I mean, you have the Inspector General Act, but it might even be in the best interest to ensure the comparability of pay and benefits to have them both clearly defined in this legislation.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing it does, it firms up how what you talked about, LEAP, which is law enforcement availability pay, which is essentially a practical way to deal with all the overtime that federal agents do. I mean, you're available 24/7. You can be called out at any time. I've often wondered if they, you know, really did an analysis and studied what they would have to pay you all, particularly Secret Service agents, you know, who are out there in protective details and like, you know, if they added up what all the true overtime dollars were, you know, the whole LEAP legislation was really designed to make it administratively workable, and I think really to save the government money.
Well, you know, that's funny you mention that, Tony. That's one of the things we've been working on conceptually and sort of now making the rounds to lay the groundwork for 2011. And that is that if we can't have the LEAP hours and pay removed from the pay cap, we'd like Congress to be able to come up with legislation that would allow a recapture of all those LEAP hours that agents, supervisors, SACs are not compensated for, and have that either A, applied as a credit towards their retirement annuity, B, come up with some form of tax credit, or C, allow those hours to be converted to dollars and deposited into the thrift savings plan for each individual.
We're going to have to stop here to hear a word from our sponsor. This is our final break. When we return, I want to just summarize that pay cap issue, and we'll wrap up any other loose items that we have. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
And now, a word from our good friends at GEICO, where you could save 15% on car insurance. By now, you've no doubt seen those car insurance commercials with the talking gecko on TV. He's always talking about how people could save 15% or more switching to GEICO. Well, that sounds like a pretty good deal in and of itself. But get this. If you're an employee of the federal government, you may be eligible to save even more than that. That's something the GEICO didn't mention in all those commercials. And you've probably heard many times about how many people have switched to GEICO. Millions. But what you might not know is how many people stay with GEICO once they've switched. In fact, on average, GEICO customers who are federal employees have stayed with the company for over 20 years. Now that's customer satisfaction. Sound like a good deal to you? Then just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO or go online to geico.com and find out how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're entering into our last segment of the show. If you have a question or comment, you can still call in. Our number is 1-877-936-9333 or email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Before the break, John, you were talking about the issue of the pay cap, and I want to just make sure our listeners understand. When I talked about LEAP and the overtime, essentially what that means is it's a 25% premium on your base pay. But there is a federal pay cap that applies that a federal official can only make X. And the impact of this to a federal law enforcement officer who is working a tremendous amount of overtime and gets this LEAP pay is essentially you have GS-14s, 15s,
even 13s,
even
13s
now in high cost of living areas, all making the same amount of money. So they're not encouraged. It's discouraging, you know, to move up through management, you know, ranks, and it's bad business, I would say.
It is. It's disconcerting where you have to go to work, and part of the LEAP process is over the course of the year, you have to work a 10-hour day every day. So an average of 2 hours above and beyond your normal 8-hour tour of duty. So in effect, you're required to work that irrespective of whether you max out, which means you hit that maximum pay level. You still continue to work those hours. And, you know, it's just something where it would be sort of reassuring that there would be some form of incentive to recapture that amount so people understand that, you know, it adds up to something. And we all love, I mean, for God and country, we do everything and we're not complaining. But it just seems to stand to reason that there should be a mechanism to recapture those hours so that law enforcement can be properly compensated in some way for it.
All right. Well, let's move on. We've got about 10 minutes left. Let's talk about something you've been working on, the 9/11, September 11th health bill. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and just before we move on, I was remiss in not acknowledging Congressman Stephen Lynch, who introduced the Postal Inspection Equity Bill. Greatly appreciate his sustained support, and I just want to make sure and let everyone know we do appreciate his support, not only on that issue, but in federal law enforcement issues in general. Now, moving forward, the bill that you're referring to, Tony, is H.R. 847, the James Adroga 9/11 health bill. What that bill attempts to do, or will accomplish if passed, is it'll establish a permanent funding mechanism to provide medical treatment and screening for those individuals who functioned as first responders down at Ground Zero during the horrific attacks of September 11th. And unfortunately, due to the overwhelming amount of contaminants and toxins that the first responders were exposed to, and I'm one of them, we've seen a series and pattern of illnesses that people have been suffering from. People who are in their 30s are being diagnosed with different forms of cancer where they have no family history of it. They're in great shape, and it defies medical logic other than the fact of their sustained exposure to the contaminants and toxins at Ground Zero. So we've been working with what we call the New York Law Enforcement Coalition, led by Chris Granberg, representing all the respective NYPD police unions, as well as NAPO and FLIOA. And we've been making the rounds just trying to impress upon all members of Congress not to minimize or isolate this as a New York problem. You know, the message we're sending is every star on our flag is of equal importance. And if one star gets attacked, our entire flag is attacked. And whether a congressman has two constituents that were impacted by this or 2,000, they should all step up and support the concept of backing and supporting those who step up in times of need and emergencies and run in where most people are running away. And what this bill will accomplish in addition to the funding is it'll set up what we call centers of medical excellence, which means that cooperating medical facilities and hospitals across the country would provide screening and treatment to individuals who are in the World Health Registry so they don't have to fly all the way to New York or one other location to get treatment or be screened. And that's really important. And the other thing it'll do is it'll provide funding for continued research to help us prove that these terminal illnesses that people are contracting have a direct nexus to their exposure. So it's important that we get that dedicated funding so that the response will be when a 35-year-old marathon athlete contracts pulmonary cancer, the obvious conclusion is when there's no medical history in their family, it was a result of their sustained exposure to the 9/11 toxins.
Just looking at this from the perspective of a federal employee and just thinking about issues such as disability, workers' comp. I mean, is there anything in there? You talked about the nexus. You know, if you have people who have responded and these symptoms aren't manifested themselves until 10, sometimes 15 years later, almost like Agent Orange in the Vietnam era. I mean, is there anything, any studies in there to talk about that, you know, that somebody may be entitled to workers' comp, you know, but how do you establish the nexus so many years later?
Right. You know what? It's almost like it's medical mission creep and sort of keeping up with the times and recognizing or going outside of, you know, the conservative Marcus Welby box of open your mouth and say, ah, and if your tonsils aren't the shape of bowling balls, you're fine. You know, we have to evolve past that. One of the things we're seeing, a very scary trend, is for those law enforcement officers who are involved in investigating and conducting raids on meth labs have contracted similar symptoms to mirror those who have been exposed to the 9/11 toxins. There's a program, the Utah Meth Cop program, which one of my board members has gone through and tremendously benefited from. And it's those sort of, you know, innovative, proactive, thinking outside the box programs that are actually saving lives. And I think in terms of disability, one of the struggles my board member had was with the Department of Labor, they simply could not wrap their administrative minds around his exposure, his symptoms, and the result. And while he sits there suffering from 15 debilitating symptoms and ailments, they want to know and they want to see his diary documenting every single exposure he's had in the last 10 years. And yet he's produced, in his case, letters from commanding officers saying that when guys sort of led back, Tim was the first one through to the door and the last one to leave. And just even by support from the state attorney general, I mean, a variety of people to sort of, if nothing else, eliminate any doubt about Tim's exposure. And yet the Department of Labor just simply will sort of prolong this administrative shuffle and not provide the approval for expedited, crucial first responder medical care. That's one of the things we're working on, Tony, on the Hill, which is to bring about OWCP, which is workers' compensation reform. It's desperately needed, and we're sort of working with the Department of Labor right now to come up with some sort of mechanism where we could have a specialty unit there to provide, you know, targeted care to law enforcement. And we're not asking for anything above and beyond what anyone else would get. We just simply want people who are trained to recognize and respond to our injuries in a timely and professional manner.
Well, and that's something a little bit different, a little bit broader. You know, I mean, the federal law enforcement, you're unique in so many ways, and you're treated that way for terms of, you know, pay and benefits, your retirement. It almost just makes sense. You know, I mean, your injuries are unique too, you know, and how you can get back to work or not back to work, you know, or, you know, are you able to qualify with your firearm under certain medications? You know, it just seems that a specialized unit would be able to process, those types of claims, you know, far more efficiently and appropriately. I'm curious, it seems like you've got a lot of New York support for it. What about, you know, how's it going, I guess?
Well, you know, first, Representative Carolyn Maloney, she's done an outstanding job sort of embracing both sides of the aisle to support this important bill. On May 25th, it was successfully marked up at a full committee, so now it's just awaiting to get on the House calendar. On the Senate side of the aisle, we have Senate Bill 1334, introduced by Senator Gillibrand, and we're sort of excited and optimistic about now that we're starting to see some movement there. We fully expect that the Senate will, in quick fashion, you know, be able to sort of wrap their minds around the concept, the importance of it, address those questions which are important and should be responded to that individual senators may have. But we want to see movement. We want to see something positive get done before the recess. So if nothing else, we can ensure that those who go out there and put their lives on the line have the full respect of all members of Congress, and they have peace of mind knowing that when we run in, and we'll never stop running in first, at least we know our government or our Congress supports us.
John, we have about a minute left. I think you wanted to give a shout out to a particular congressman.
Yes, we had the privilege, somewhat overdue, to present an award to Congressman Brad Ellsworth. Congressman Ellsworth, back in, I believe, November 2007, introduced a concept that we brought to him called what we call the Congressional Badge of Bravery. Then Senator Biden introduced the companion bill on the Senate side. It was ultimately signed into law July 31st, 2008, by President Bush. What that bill calls for, now law, is to create something what you might say is similar to a Purple Heart, but for law enforcement, local, state, and federal, where you sustain injury in the line of duty under heroic circumstances, you will receive, based on it going through a review committee, which the respective law enforcement stakeholder organizations will sit on, you'll receive a congressional award acknowledging your heroism, and it's an important bill, and we're just happy as all can be that Congressman Ellsworth, who's a career law enforcement officer and now making a strong run for the Senate in Indiana, has been behind us every step of the way, and we just greatly appreciate all that he's done, as well as Vice President Biden, in making sure this important bill was signed into law.
Well, folks, that's all the time we have for today's show. Thank you so much for joining us. John, thank you for joining me. It was a great discussion. Fed Talk is brought to you by the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth. Hope everybody has a great weekend and hope to see you out on the golf course.
The Home Depot has made a special buy on 2 cubic foot bags of Scott's NatureScapes mulch. Now just $3.44, which is great for your wallet.